Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, folks. Let me tell you about Luke's English Podcast Premium. There's a thing called Luke's English Podcast Premium, and it's my paid subscription service. In premium episodes, I do my best to help you expand your vocabulary, understand grammar, and improve your pronunciation. I publish the episodes on my website and in the Luke's English Podcast app. If you'd like to sign up or just get more information, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info. You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello, listeners. In this episode, you can hear me having a conversation with Christian from Kangaroo English. Do you know about Kangaroo English? Some of you will already be aware of it. Kangaroo English is a YouTube channel, it's an Instagram account, it's a Facebook page, it's a Twitter account, and it's also an audio podcast. And it's all the work of Christian Saunders, an English teacher who originally comes from Australia but now lives and works in Spain. By the way, the kangaroo part is spelled C-A-N-G-U-R-O, and it's spelled like that because it's pronounced exactly the same as the word kangaroo when pronounced in Christian's Aussie accent. The kangaroo, of course, being one of the symbols of Australia. And I'm now thinking, do you know what a kangaroo is? I don't know if everyone knows. It's that animal that has a long tail, large hind legs, and a pouch on its belly. They jump around the Australian outback and, in fact, can only be found in Australia, I think. Unless, you know, you go to the zoo or something. But anyway, say the word kangaroo in an Aussie accent and it sounds like it should be spelled C-A-N-G-U-R-O, kangaroo. Anyway, I've been aware of Christian from Kangaroo English and his work for a few years now, as his videos often pop up in my suggested videos section on YouTube. Christian teaches English in his videos, like many other YouTube English teachers, but over the last few years, he's focused on delivering messages about changing the way that we learn and teach languages, the importance of taking responsibility for your own language learning, and generally exploring the psychology and philosophy of learning other languages, especially English. When I see Christian's videos, I'm always struck by how passionate he is about his work, how he manages to communicate quite complex ideas using simple language in a clear and engaging manner, his use of metaphors and visual demonstrations, and a generally thoughtful and generous approach to helping people not only learn English, but to think about how they approach the learning of English. Then recently, Christian did an event on social media in order to raise money for educational charity. Some of you might have seen it. The video involved him reading every single word from a copy of the Merriam-Webster Dictionary live on YouTube, which is actually much harder than it sounds, going through the dictionary and just reading out the words listed. He sat in front of the camera with the dictionary in front of him and proceeded to read each word one by one, and he continued doing it for 18 solid hours. You can find the video on YouTube. I think the video itself maybe cuts out after about 11 or 12 hours. I'm not sure. Maybe there was like a technical issue, but apparently he did do it for 18 full hours. I watched some of it and it was impressive, not just because it was for a good cause. He was doing it for an educational charity, the project being to build a school in a country where, you know, children desperately need educational facilities. So it was impressive, not just because it was for a good cause, but because it just seemed so tough. After 10 hours or something, he seemed to be totally exhausted. His eyes were hurting. His face was hurting. His brain was hurting. He must have been going mad sitting in front of that huge tome with so many thousands of words ahead of him. And the whole time there were people in the comments section encouraging him, cheering him on, and donating money to the educational charity he was promoting. The aim being to raise $50,000 to go towards the building of a school for poor children. Was it dollars or euros? I can't remember at this point. Anyway, after watching Christian for a while, I went to bed. And I woke up early the next morning and checked YouTube, and he was still going. And I decided there and then that it was about time I talked to him on my podcast, just because I wanted to know what it was like for him, to let him explain why he was doing it, and also just to get stuck into a wider conversation about lots of other things. And that's what you're going to hear in this episode. I sort of had a feeling that Christian and I would get on quite well and that we'd have plenty to talk about, and I wasn't wrong, as you'll hear in our chat. This was a long conversation, but it went by really quickly, and it was really enjoyable to actually talk to Christian properly after having seen his thought-provoking videos on YouTube. Our conversation covers things like catching COVID-19, the Charity Dictionary Reading Marathon, Christian's story of moving to Spain and renovating an old barn into a home for him and his family, what it's like being an English teacher in classrooms, and also a content creator for learners of English online, motivation in language learning, my personal situation learning French, Christian's speaking style, how Barack Obama speaks, Paul McCartney recording an album in his kitchen, and loads of other things too. I'm very happy that I spoke to Christian because the conversation you're about to hear does contain some really important principles about language learning, including many big conclusions that both Christian and I have reached after being involved in language teaching and learning for many years. Listen carefully. There's definitely some good wisdom to be picked up from this. I hope so anyway. And at the very least, it's nice to just get to know Christian in a bit more detail. You should know that there is a YouTube video version of this conversation in which you can see both Christian and me talking to each other. So head over to my YouTube channel, Luke's English Podcast, on YouTube to find it. And don't forget to like and subscribe when you do that. That's right. Smash that like button, guys. You will also find the YouTube video of this conversation embedded on the page for this episode on my website. That's it for my introduction then. I'll talk to you again briefly at the end of this episode. But now I will let you get stuck into this conversation with Christian from Kangaroo English. And here we go. Christian from Kangaroo English. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. Is it a good morning? You just told me that the weather is a bit rubbish today.
Yeah, the weather's not very good today. And I think there must be something in the air as well, because we have two cats, and one of them is a kind of an older, kind of obese female cat, and we also have a young male kitten who's like 20 kilos lighter, and they've just been fighting constantly for the past 2 days.
Oh, really?
So that's been nice. Constant rain and cats fighting. It's been nice.
Yeah, it's a kind of sign of the times, isn't it? It's kind of a weird time where cats fight and it rains and there's a virus going around and all that sort of thing. I was going to say, how are you? You had the coronavirus, didn't you? You caught it.
I did, yes. I went to Italy in March, like just when, in fact, I was in the north of Italy in Torino. Mm-hmm. And at that moment, the I can't remember now the name of the province, but there was a province in the north of Italy, which is basically next to Torino. And that was the first place in Europe that had the virus really bad. I don't know if you remember. Mm. And that was blocked off, so nobody was in and out. But, you know, nobody was taking the virus seriously. I wasn't taking it seriously. No one in Torino was taking it seriously. I caught it, and I was quite sick for a few weeks. I was never in mortal danger. I was just, you know, I just felt terrible.
What kind of symptoms?
But, I funnily enough, you know, I never had any breathing problems, which is the, you know, the normally the number one symptom. And I never had any, I never had a cough or any of the typical stuff. I just felt really tired and I had really intense headaches. The worst headaches I've ever had in my life. That was pretty much it. It was like an extended hangover. It was like drinking a bottle of tequila every night for like a month,
but without any of the fun side of that.
Yes, that was the problem. That was the problem.
Okay, are you okay now though? You don't have any sort of lasting issues with that or anything?
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, you know, I've definitely felt better in my life. You know what I mean? But whether I can attribute that to you know, some long-lasting effects of COVID or the fact that, you know, 2020 has just, everyone's life has been turned upside down.
Yeah.
It's difficult to say. I mean, how are you coping with this?
Oh, dear. Well, obviously we have to, you know, wear masks and stuff. And now in Paris where I live, they've brought in a curfew. So after, you know, 9 p.m., you're not allowed to basically go outside unless you're working. So it's just weird. It's you know what it's like. It's a weird atmosphere and it's hard to know. Every, you know, you're just sort of living day by day and sometimes it starts to prey on your mind of kind of like, how long are we going to be doing this? And I worry about my parents catching it and stuff like that, and they're far from me. I can't go and travel back home to England to see them, my family and friends. So sometimes there's that sense of isolation that I think we're all experiencing, and that kind of low level sense of kind of fear or paranoia or something going around. I got ill, gosh, when was it? Probably just over a week ago, maybe a week and a half ago. I got sick and I had a temperature and I had a really sore throat and I felt exhausted. And I thought, oh God, here we go. I must have COVID and this is going to be a real pain because it means that my wife's going to have to stay at home. My daughter, who is nearly three, won't be able to go to school. It's going to make life so difficult. And plus I felt terrible, went down to get tested, stood outside the testing center for about 2 hours in the rain. Thankfully I had an umbrella and, you know, a coat on and stuff. Finally got tested. They shoved a, you know, you've probably, yeah, you know, you have the test, you've had the test.
Yeah.
They horrible. Shove a sort of cotton buds right down your nasal cavity, which is quite horrible. And then got the test results negative, meaning the result was negative, which was positive. It's weird, isn't it? Like it's a negative result is positive, but it's also not positive, you know. So yeah. I didn't have it, which is good. Even though there was a slight sense of like, oh, right, okay. So what's the matter with me then? I think I was just tired and I just had like, you know, a seasonal thing. But yeah, you know, I think it's probably similar to what everyone else is experiencing.
Yeah.
It just makes life complicated and difficult. But, you know, I just obviously I have to say that, you know, we're thinking about the people who have been properly affected by this and stuff like that. I don't know. We could go into it more, but I think that we can probably just move on. But anyway, you're all right. That's the main thing.
Yeah, I'm totally fine.
It's kind of funny to be talking to you because I've seen you on YouTube quite a lot. You know, you pop up in my YouTube recommended videos. I think I'm subscribed to your channel. Yeah. So it's kind of funny to be talking to you. I guess the reason why I decided to speak to you, I've been meaning to kind of get in touch with you for ages, is I saw your dictionary challenge and it was amazing. It was quite impressive and also a little bit worrying because it seemed to be so exhausting. So can you just tell us about the dictionary challenge? What was it? Just in case people don't know what we're talking about.
Yeah, no, of course. Well, so a few years ago, I wanted to raise some money for charity. And because I was talking to this guy in my small town, who'd just come back from Athens in Greece, and he had been there volunteering at this center, where basically, because in general, you know, Greece is the gateway through Europe for a lot of immigrants, you know, from North Africa, from the Middle East. And so this place is just this like 5-story building in the middle of Athens. It's run by all Spanish people, which is very strange, right? So there's all these Spaniards in the middle of Athens, yeah, working on this refugee project. And so they give them meals, they give them English classes, they have like a massive clothes bank. And all of this is done from donations from people in Spain. And so I had the idea, well, why don't I try and help somehow? And I wanted to do like an event, and I knew it had to be a kind of long event because years ago I didn't have that many subscribers. I think at that point maybe I had, you know, 10,000 followers or something, maybe 15,000. Mm-hmm. So I knew if I wanted to raise a lot of money, I needed to do something long.
Yeah.
And I had this idea to just read the dictionary. And in fact, I wasn't the first person to do it. I don't know if you know the YouTuber called Mr. Beast.
I've heard of Mr. Beast. I've never actually seen his stuff.
Mr. Beast does basically really kind of childish challenges, like, but with expensive stuff. Like, for example, people have to put their hand on a Ferrari, okay, and the last person to take their hand off the Ferrari gets the Ferrari. Stuff like that.
Ah, right. Wow.
Like, so all these weird...
He's giving away a Ferrari?
Yes. He gives away houses, cars, islands, just crazy stuff.
How? Yeah,
crazy stuff. He is one of the most subscribed channels on YouTube. And it's an indication of, you know, when you're at the top of your game, like any industry, right? Like, you know, the top CEOs, the top musicians, the top, they're earning a crazy amount of money. Like, yeah, it's unimaginable how much money they're earning.
Mm.
But I mean, the thing that I like about Mr. Beast, and I don't actually watch his content because it's kind of, well, I don't really, it's not in my sphere of interest.
Yes.
But, he's all about raising money to essentially give it away. So a lot of his challenges are like, he goes into a supermarket and buys everything. So when he walks out, all the food is gone. They're just empty shelves. And then he'll take all that food and give it to a food bank. Stuff like that, you know? So, yeah. There's like a focus on charity. Anyway, sorry for the big detour there.
It's fine.
But he actually has a video from like 2010 or something, like years ago, and he sat and read the dictionary. But it was like a little pocket dictionary, and it took him about 6 hours. So anyway, a few years ago, I wanted to try and read the whole Oxford Dictionary. And at that point... it was me and my wife and another teacher and people from the community and also other YouTube teachers. And so we took turns, basically, at doing it. And it took about 43 hours or something, 44 hours.
Wow.
And that was, it was really good. We raised money. The company Scholastic did an amazing deal on teaching materials. And so we bought these materials with the money that we raised, and we went to Athens, and I made a video about it, and it was awesome. And this year I wanted to do it again, but I kind of decided to do it last minute, and I didn't have time to organize it with other teachers. So I thought, okay, I can do this. You know, I can do this myself, I'm sure, because, like, with my work, I kind of get a bit obsessed about my work, and so it's not unusual for me to work all night and, you know, then the next day. So I knew that I could stay awake.
Yeah.
That wasn't a problem. And also, I read a few pages from the dictionary and timed myself, and I said, okay, it's going to take about 27, 28 hours. I can do that. You know, it's like one day of reading. I can do that. But of course, the problem is when you sit down to read, you can't maintain the speed necessary, right? Yeah. It starts to kind of hurt. Like my face was hurting just from constantly talking. You know, my vocal cords were hurting. It sounds so pathetic, doesn't it?
Oh, my poor vocal cords.
My poor vocal cords. So, you know, there's people out there, you know, soldiers in, you know, in on the front line, and I'm complaining about my vocal cords. But anyway, yeah, it starts to hurt. And obviously, you know, just the concentration required to just read constantly, I started to get slower and slower and slower. And so After 18 hours, I was not even halfway through. I was probably a third, maybe not even a third. So it would have taken me at least 60 hours, but probably more. And I knew I couldn't do it, so I had to. I did 18 hours, and I had to call it a day.
It's a pretty good innings.
It was. I was disappointed in myself. My father-in-law was very disappointed in me. He's been talking about it constantly, about how he wants his money back because I gave up. it was really good. And we raised about $10,000.
Wow. Yeah, good.
But we're not finished yet because we want to raise 50. And so soon I'm going to do something with my community on Facebook to try and raise the rest of the money. So we'll see, because I forgot to actually say that the point is that all the money went to this charity called Pencils of Promise, and they build schools in lots of different countries in the world, you know, with underprivileged children.
Mm-hmm.
I like the idea of building a school because it's a generational thing. And basically, you know, by every single metric, so that's like life expectancy, you know, happiness, earnings, by every single metric, education makes your life better. So that's why I think it's important, and that's why I think that everybody should have access to free education as well.
Where will the school be?
I don't know. There's some candidate countries. There's like Nicaragua is one, Laos in Southeast Asia. They're the two probably best candidates. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I see. Okay.
Yeah.
If people want to donate, how do they do it?
The event will officially end on New Year's Eve, December 31st. And if they want to donate, they can go to kangarooenglish.com/donate.
Okay.
Which redirects you directly to the Pencils of Promise website.
kangarooenglish.com/donate.
Yes.
Okay. Right. So reading from the dictionary then, were you making, obviously you were raising money for charity, were you making another point about learning English? Was there another point to it?
No, there was no other point. I think what was really, and I know this is going to sound really strange, but even though I read the Oxford Dictionary like 4 years ago, reading Merriam-Webster Dictionary, which I did this time, it had a different feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously if you have an online dictionary, you essentially have unlimited space, right? Every word that you've written a definition for, you include it in your online dictionary. But when it comes to printed dictionary, you have to make hard choices about what kind of vocabulary goes in, what kind goes out. And I noticed that Merriam-Webster was really heavy on the scientific vocabulary. And that just made it an absolute nightmare to read. You know, it's like, there was whole sections of like chemical names, like, you know, dihydroextras, methylosone. I was just, oh my God.
Yeah. And where's the word stress in that?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and also another thing that was different was that in the Oxford Dictionary, you have the word printed, just the full word. And then next to that, you have the IPA. In the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, they break the word into syllables. So you have the part of the word, then the dot to mark the syllable. So when you're reading a word, when it's broken up like that, it requires extra cognitive effort to put it together.
Mm.
Like, for example, the word effort would be EF dot FORT. So when you're reading, if you're reading quickly, you go effort, and then you're like, wait a second, no, it's not effort, it's effort. I know that word, but because it's written differently, my brain just says no. You don't know what that word is. So every dictionary, I imagine, has a different kind of flavor to it, right? A different vibe.
Yeah. I see. Do you think that learners of English should use dictionaries in their learning routines?
I mean, a question that students ask me sometimes is, should I use a monolingual or a bilingual dictionary? And there's, believe it or not, there's actually been a little bit of research done about that, you know, where they put students in classrooms and they ask them to learn vocabulary with monolingual or bilingual dictionaries. Mm. And they didn't find any difference, which is kind of not surprising to me because at the end of the day, you know, your brain is... I think people who kind of push the idea of monolingual dictionaries, I think that the kind of theory is that if you stay in the target language, so if you're learning English and you're using a monolingual English dictionary, then you're kind of performing this brain magic where suddenly the word only exists in the English part of your brain, right? It's like because you're avoiding the translation part, it's like you magically have it there available in English. But, you know, I mean, the neuroscience is pretty clear that's not how, that's not how we learn vocabulary. That, you know, when you're learning a second language, especially as an adult, right, you know, you go from the word in your native language. So for me, it would be English. And then if I want to learn a Spanish word, I have to go through that English word to get to the Spanish word, right? So it's like word and then no, so it's like Spanish word, then English word, then meaning. You know, I have to go through
You have
through
to
the,
translate it to English for it to because the meaning already exists there in English.
Exactly.
So you have to attach it to that English word. But that's, I guess, where the problem is also.
Yeah, I mean, so at the beginning, you know, when you first learn new words, you go through your native language. But then over time, you know, the more abilities you gain in your second language and the more you are exposed to that word, you form that direct connection with the meaning. So you don't need to go through your native language anymore. And that's, you know, that's when we could say that you sort of become fluent, right? Because you're, in a way, the connection becomes, you know, automatic rather than a process of translation, a process of actually having to kind of, let's say, think about what it means.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, and when do people get to that stage then, when they're not having to, you know, actively translate words, when it's just all sort of flowing directly in the target language?
I think it's impossible to say. I think everybody's different, I imagine. You know, I think there's so many factors, right? It's like age of exposure. There's also lots of evidence about how kind of core vocabulary. So like, let's say the first 1,000 words that you learn as a child, which would be the most common words, you know, in any language, you know, those words are stored in a much deeper way in your brain than vocabulary that you would only encounter, let's say, twice a year or something.
Mm.
And so I would say that those words that you're encountering more often, they would probably become, you know, they would become a lot quicker for you to become, let's say, fluent in. Only because you're exposed to them more often. I don't think there's any, you know, I don't think there's any kind of secret here. It's just if you're exposed to a word a lot, you just automatically know what it means, right?
Yeah, just context.
Yeah,
you just piece it together, and as you hear it more and more, it just gets reinforced again and again. Especially if you're using it too, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm trying to learn Arabic at the moment, and it's obviously when I was at high school, I learned French, learned French.
Yeah.
Because you live in Paris, right?
I do.
Yeah. Yeah. How's your French?
Not very good. Nice. But as I always say, you know, my French is not as good as it should be, but my excuses are improving all the time. I'm very fluent, in excuses, but you know, that some of the they're all excuses. But no, it's not as good as it should be. But I also learned French at GCSE level in school, and I got a B,
yeah,
which was, you know, okay, not bad. But then, well, God, how many years was it from when I left school and promptly rejected everything that I'd learned at the age of 16? To when I actually started using French when I met my wife. She wasn't my wife when I met her. That would have been weird. But so yeah, a long time passed, and sort of, you know, a lot of that went out the window. And the real experience of living in France, and just for me, it you know, I moved here when I was, how old was I? Oh God, I don't know, 35 or 36 or something like that. And it was more just like the challenge of like just trying to live my life. And I felt like I didn't have that much time to kind of, you know, basically it's about needing to speak French. And there are times when I definitely need it, but then a lot of the time on a day-to-day basis, I can kind of go through my day with a certain level of French. I feel bad. I often make a fool of myself, and I feel ashamed that my French isn't better, but it's kind of like, yeah, enough to survive on. But then, yeah, then I will go to a party or something and I'm completely lost and I feel totally awful. Yeah. It's a bit complicated. It's all wrapped up in psychology and, yeah, stuff.
No, I mean, I think to me it was really interesting, the vocabulary that you just used when you were describing your experience learning French, mm-hmm, right? So you said that, you know, you studied French for GCSEs.
Yeah.
And then you said, but then when I actually started using French,
yeah,
right, which is like, which makes me just think, you know, what a shame, right? What a shame that we've got kids in a learning environment who are kind of in a learning mode as well. You know, they know, you know, they're prepared to be there, they're prepared to study, and we're kind of wasting their time, you know, filling them with things that are probably mostly just grammatical points, right? It's more like, yeah, let's learn about the grammar of French. You know, here's a list of vocabulary. When we could actually have generations of children actually using French, right? So that when, yeah, they leave the classroom, they can go and do stuff like live in Paris and go to parties and have great conversations.
Yeah. The only time I remember actually using French properly in a meaningful conversation was the oral exam for GCSE, where I sat with my French teacher and finally had a conversation with her for about 10 minutes. And I did, you know, reasonably well, yeah, because I've been practicing for it. But yeah, the only things I remember from my French classes at school were embarrassingly having to talk to the kid next to me about my pet cat. And and then mainly like the girls at the back of the classroom and boys at the back of the classroom just kind of completely ruining the lesson because they hated it. I remember one particular incident that always sticks with me is that a girl fainted, and it was pretty obvious that she was faking it. I mean, it's like almost like everyone knew that it wasn't real. It's like almost like there was this feeling in the classroom of like, she's blatantly faking it and she's getting away with it. And everyone was like, good, because now we can just mess around while the teacher has to deal with this situation. So just a lot of unwillingness on the part of the students, and yeah, just the teacher struggling and getting angry with the kids. And,
yeah,
you know, just the practicality, yeah, of it.
Well, I mean, that's another thing to consider here. I mean, if we're talking about the classroom, you know, the general classroom experience, and obviously there's been a move since we went to school, you know, towards, well, it depends on the country, right? But there's been kind of a general move towards a more communicative approach. Mm. But, you know, basically when I think about, you know, the general classroom experience, the teacher also is probably not enjoying themselves. You know, mm-hmm, they're under pressure to kind of teach to the test, because if we look at the UK, for example, you know, that there's lots of the testing that's done for, you know, on a national level, on a, on an individual school level. And that means that teachers have a big responsibility to teach the stuff that's going to be in the test. And, you know, that's, you know, where's, you know, I wonder how much joy the average language teacher, you know, experiences, because their freedom is restricted, right? It's not as if they have the freedom to say, well, I'm going to take this group of kids and I'm going to teach them to just at least be able to operate on in a fundamental way. No, because, you know, on Friday we've, you know, got a test about present simple or whatever. Yeah. And I think it's so, you know, we need change not just for the students, but also for the teachers. So that, like you say, they're not getting angry and frustrated because the kids are bored.
Yes, know? Yes, exactly. Yeah. Also, I basically, for me personally now in my life, I need to make a personal commitment to my French, and I need to find my own personal reasons for it. You know, there's a lot of that. It's a lot about finding your own personal motivation and your own personal goals and unlocking that. And I'm a bit self-deprecating about my French. I do find some things, I do have some things that I love doing in French, like reading graphic novels is the thing that I've found. I've been searching for the right podcast. I've been searching for the right things to use. I can't really speak French with my wife because she has the patience of a Parisian woman.
The patience of a Parisian waiter.
Well, yeah, that kind of thing where basically it's like, your French isn't good enough, let's just do this in English, which is kind of like the Parisian waiter's approach. And we started our relationship in English, and it's very difficult to switch and all those things. But I found some things really, really nice and motivating, like reading graphic novels are really good.
This is something that I get a lot of criticism for, you know, from maybe from some other teachers, but actually ironically from a lot of students, is that they say that I kind of promote laziness. Uh-huh. Because if I was, you know, your teacher, if I was your French teacher, I would say to you, look, you know, if you can kind of on a day-to-day basis do all the things you need to do and you struggle occasionally, I would say that you should be happy with that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But if you're going to parties regularly, or if you're kind of like, you know, if you're struggling regularly and you're feeling super frustrated about not being able to, you know, kind of express your ideas, I mean, maybe it's affecting your work, for example, then I would say, yeah, you need to work on that. You know, people say, oh, well, Christian, you're just promoting laziness, because we should all try to, aim to be the best we could be and to aim for perfection. And, you know, this, you're just a symptom of, this modern thing where even people who come fifth in the race, they get a prize, right? Yeah. They get a trophy as well.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know. If I take a historical view of language learning, you know, language learning has in a way always been about necessity, the first people to learn other languages, you know, well before the ancient Greeks, and I'm talking about the hunter-gatherers, you know, they learned languages because they needed to trade, or they needed to maybe make peace or whatever they needed to do. They weren't interested in fluency or perfection as some kind of abstract, you know, goal, right? Yeah. And I think you said it before, actually. It's like, you don't really have a need. Like, you either don't have the need or you haven't created the need. So I would say it's okay.
I mean,
how do you
feel? To give a bit more information about my situation. So I am going to apply for French citizenship for various reasons, just because, you know, ultimately it's going to be easier for me and Brexit and all that stuff.
Yes.
They require a B1 level of French, and I've had the test and I got it. I got B1. So, you know,
nice.
In that sense, I'm doing all right. But yeah, there is the sense that, I mean, we're getting a bit personal here, but the sense that it sort of does hold me back in various ways, not being able to communicate in French the way I want. But, you know, it's something for me to work on.
Well, I mean, then I would say to you, yeah, if that's how you feel, and, you know, and if that is actually, you know, if it is, and that's something that you have to reflect on, right?
Mm.
Then I would say, yeah, you would probably feel better about actually, you know, dedicating some time to improving your French.
Right? Yeah, I've got to just organize myself. It's just, you know, I'm 43 now, and, you know, I've learned that I'm not the most organized person. And I'm a bit like you. If I get into one project, I just kind of obsessively go for that at the expense of
everything else.
Yeah. So kind of like, oh, I've got this podcast, you know, I've recorded this podcast with Christian. I've got to, you know, edit this and get this ready and then get it up online. Whereas, you know, my French is kind of going, but what about me? And I'm like, oh, okay, I'll do you in a bit. You know, so I need to get my priorities sorted out. It's, you know, it's complicated. Life is pretty complicated. It's difficult to get everything done.
And I think that's one fundamental thing that is kind of overlooked, right? Like if you look at, let's say, a majority of courses that are being sold right now, and they could be courses, you know, from huge organizations like Pearson or even just, you know, like individual kind of language gurus.
Yeah.
There's always kind of that promise of fluency, right? It's mm-hmm. always like the end goal. But I think there's very few adults who really have the time and the patience to be able to achieve that. And so I think, I don't know, I mean, maybe I am, maybe there is an element of truth about me promoting laziness, right? But I would say that a general lowering of expectations among adults would probably lead to more success, because, you know, you would feel like, well, the only thing that I wanted to do was to be able to, I don't know, say my name, say my age, ask how you are. You know, if that's, you know, your objective, and it's a small objective, and it's a low expectation, you achieve that, you feel good, and then you want to keep going.
Yeah, right? Definitely. I don't think you're promoting laziness. I think you're just accepting that laziness is a thing that exists. And that, you know, it's just like, let's just accept that human beings, especially adults, are lazy or busy or confused or whatever, that they don't necessarily have the you know, the time, the energy to devote themselves to language learning in the way that would be the most effective. So we're taking this into account. Let's take a more realistic approach to setting goals and then achieving those goals, because ultimately having perfection as your goal can be crushing. It can be, it's extremely difficult. Agreed. It's like climbing Mount Everest. Some people can do it, you know, and people do it actually every day, you know, with the example of Mount Everest, but also many people die on that mountain. There are lots of frozen dead bodies up there, language learners who've attempted to achieve perfection and who've perished in some way in the process. You know, it can be destructive. It can be quite damaging. Obviously, it's good to have those sorts of ideals. And, you know, many people succeed, but a lot of people don't. And so we're working on a pragmatic, on a pragmatic level of like, you know, let's break it down a bit. Let's simplify it, and let's try to get more realistic goals. And ultimately, motivation is the most important thing. And we just want to help people learn English or any other language in a way that allows them to stay motivated. So I think, you know.
Exactly.
I think, you know, people.
I love that analogy. The Mount Everest it's perfect, actually. But isn't it funny how technology has made climbing Mount Everest a lot easier? Because as you say, there's people summiting like every day now, isn't there?
There's a queue of people lining up.
Yeah. It's crazy, you know. I'm sure that 30 years ago that wasn't a thing at all. Unfortunately, technology isn't really a help to us, you know, as teachers.
No?
I don't think so, because I don't think that, I can't think of any evidence that technology improves outcomes. I mean, it might make certain things, let's say, less tedious. So if you, you know, one really effective way to learn vocabulary is using spaced repetition. So, you know, flashcards, basically. And obviously, software like Anki or Memrise, you know, that makes doing flashcards a lot easier and more, you know, methodical. So in that sense, it kind of makes the learning process easier. But it doesn't change the way that the brain learns, right? Because the brain is the same now as it was 30 years ago. And although flashcards can help you to remember vocabulary, you're still not going to be able to, you know, again, it's that kind of thing where you're going to have to go through your native language to get to the meaning, you know, unless you also output them, unless you produce that vocabulary, then it's not going to become automatic, right? So you still have to do the same amount of kind of hard work. You still have to, the process is the same, right?
I guess anyone who has downloaded a flashcards app on their phone, loaded it up with vocab, and then not used it, will agree with you that you still have to do the work. You know, the it's, you know, buying the app or buying the textbook or buying the course of classes in your local language school isn't enough. There's no way of escaping the fact that you've still got to put the time in and all that stuff.
I don't know if you know this, but there's a really interesting fact about MOOCs. So MOOCs are massive online open courses. And in fact, one of the biggest MOOCs that was ever published was made by the British Council. And it was a MOOC about how to pass the IELTS exam.
Mm-hmm.
But an interesting kind of fact about MOOCs is that their participation... No, not participation. The completion rate of MOOCs is basically linear, like this. Right? So lesson one, you'll have 100% of people in there. By lesson 10, by the final lesson, you'll have 1%. It depends. I mean, it's not always completely linear, but it's always like that. And I think it's just human nature, right? Everyone starts with great intentions, but there's few people who'll have the, you know, the kind of discipline to see it through.
Yeah.
And that goes for anything. So it's not just English courses, you know, that's learning anything. So what's the trick? I don't know. The trick, maybe like you said, it's about, you know, it's about finding if you're into graphic novels, that's your thing, right? Yeah. Then it's not work.
Yeah. Or just breaking it down step by step. You know, like that's how you climb a mountain. You don't like look at the top all the time. It's literally you're looking at your feet and it's just step by step by step. And when you look up, it's a horrible sight because you think, oh my God, I've hardly made any progress at all. And if you look down, that's kind of scary, although that can be quite good too. Like, oh, look, we've got this far, but I'm stuck on this mountain. So just step by step, breaking it up into chunks. And yeah, just trying to find the thing that ultimately keeps you motivated, I suppose.
Yeah. I like that aspect of what you said about, I think as well, when you're making progress with another language, and it could be after, you know, a week, or it could be after 10 years, you know, like me, I think it's always actually motivating to look back and go, wow. You know, I've gone from zero to this, even if this is not very good. It's still, I mean, I think it's an amazing thing to be able to communicate with other people, you know, in another language, because it's so complicated. You know, there's so many things to consider. You know, you've got pronunciation and vocabulary and grammar and all the cultural things that you need to know about, you know, for example, in French you have the tout vous thing. I don't know how much that's still alive in French at the moment.
Oh, yeah, and it's a daily problem of like, should I use tout or vous for, like, you know, one of my daughter's school friend's parents who I sit next to in the park after school, and we just sort of like have an informal chat. It's like, oh, should I be saying tu or vu to him? And I'm terrible, because like half the time I'm saying tu and half the time I say vu, and sometimes I actually say vu tu. I say both, and, you know, like with this nice look on my face of like, which one shall I use, hoping that they find the humor in it. Sometimes they're just it just doesn't register. I don't know. So yeah, that is a daily.
What about if you go somewhere in the middle? Like, what if you do like a foo or something? So, you know.
Yeah, like foo. It's also the problem around about 6 p.m. in the evening when people switch from saying bonjour to saying bonsoir. Because yeah. in France, or maybe just in Paris, I don't know. I think it's in France generally. You have to say bonjour or bonsoir before you do anything else. Okay. Otherwise, it's rude. So if you go into the boulangerie, bonjour, bonsoir, or if you even pass a neighbor in the building, bonjour, bonsoir. And what often happens is I say bonjour and they reply bonsoir to me.
You're like, damn it.
Yeah. So it's like this, bonjour, bonsoir, and I say soir. You know, and they never find it funny, and I'm just like, oh, come on.
And when you go into the patisserie, do you order a pain au chocolat or a chocolatine?
Oh, a pain au chocolat, obviously, because this is Paris. Okay. This is a big divisive thing, as you know. chocolatine in probably in the south, I think, but in Paris it's a pain au chocolat, which I ordered this morning successfully.
Sure it was delicious because. Well, I've never had, I don't care what anybody says, there's no equivalent to French pastries anywhere in the world. Mm. They're just on there's just a different level of pastry.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, right? They are wonderful. It's true. So you're in Spain. Now, I don't know that much about you. I just know you from your videos. And certain things sort of occur to me when I see your videos. Like one of the things is like you seem to have an amazing place. Where you film your content. You seem to have lots of space. It seems like a kind of a cool artist studio or something. What's going on there? Do you have where do you record your stuff?
At the moment I'm in my house. This is my house. It's an old farmhouse in the country. I live in a tiny little village surrounded by cow farmers. But also I have a school. It's a small school. It's like three classrooms in a local kind of town, which is about 15 minutes away by car. And that's where I make my content. But I'm lucky to be surrounded by a lot of nature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at where I live on Google Maps, you just zoom out and it's just green, 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 green.
Yeah.
Just the whole way. Yeah, it's a place full of natural beauty.
So you've got your own school. You set up your own school.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, the story is that before I came to Spain, I'd done lots of different jobs, but I'd spent most of my career as a graphic designer, and all of the kind of associated, because this was around the time of kind of the popularity of the internet. So I did graphic design for websites. So I was involved a little bit in the code side of things.
Mm-hmm.
I did graphic design for DVDs. So there was like, do you remember you do put the DVD and you have the menu system?
Yeah.
Yeah. I used to do those. In fact, I was going through a box of old things the other day and I found a CD-ROM business card. Do you remember those?
Yeah, like small ones, about this big.
Yeah, yeah. And you would give it to someone and they would put it in their computer and it would be your business card with a video. And you'd be like, wow, this guy's like a CEO or something. He's got a video.
Yeah, those were the days.
Yeah, so I used to do that. And then we, me and my wife, we moved here because of my wife's parents my wife's mum is Spanish from this area, and we decided to stay, and we bought this barn, but it was a ruin, right? So it had just four walls, it had nothing inside, so we had to live in a caravan while we were doing the renovations.
Yeah,
and the caravan was supposed to be for like a few months, you know. Have you ever seen Grand Designs? Have you ever watched Grand Designs?
I know of it. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a program in which people have big projects to, for example, renovate sort of old properties, and we watch the way that the problems that they have, and eventually, hopefully, they create their dream house or something at the end.
Yeah. Well, basically, the narrative of almost every episode of Grand Designs is the same. They think it's going to cost. They think it's going to cost $1 million. It costs $10 million. They think it's going to take a week. It takes a year. Right?
Yeah.
And it was the same with us. So we actually lived in a caravan for almost 4 years.
Oh, what?
Yeah. Which at first it was romantic. It's like, we're in a caravan.
Yeah.
But then after 6 months, it's just horrible because you have to shower outside in, you know, in any weather. You have to use a chemical toilet. You know, you don't have space for literally anything. You have no possessions.
Yeah.
So it was horrible. But, you know, eventually now we're in this house. And, well, the reason I'm telling you the story.
Yeah.
it's not an episode of Grand Designs. is one night when we were in the caravan, a neighbor came knocking on the caravan and said, I work on boats. He works on oil tankers, and these oil tankers have international crews. So the kind of the de facto language of communication is English. But they at that time, 10 years ago, they were changing the rules, and you needed to have an English certificate to prove that you had a level of English before they would give you a job on the boat.
Right. Okay.
So he needed to pass this exam, and he wanted to practice with a native speaker. So he said, "Can we have conversation class? Can we talk?" I'm like, "Okay, sure." And in that class, he brought along a copy of English Grammar in Use.
So this is when you were technically a graphic designer at this time.
Well, at that particular moment, I wasn't. Yeah, I was making websites at that moment. Yep.
You weren't. You hadn't become an English teacher at this point.
No.
Okay.
No. I knew nothing about. I mean, I'd always liked language, like creative language, like writing and things.
Yeah.
I'd always read a lot, you know, but I'd never. And this was a shocking thing to me, is that he brought along this copy of English Grammar in Use, which is, for a lot of English teachers, the kind of Bible. It's this blue book. It's published by Cambridge University Press.
Yeah.
It's written by Raymond Murphy.
This is an old edition that I'm showing here.
It's an old edition.
On the video, but yes, Raymond Murphy's English Grammar in Use. This is the second edition.
Okay. I think they're on the fourth edition now, actually. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that is actually it's an amazing book. I actually really love that book, personally.
Yeah, me too.
But when I started looking at it, I realized, you know, that I knew nothing about my own language. Like, I literally had no idea. I didn't know. I'd never heard of the past perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I'd never even heard that. I didn't know that existed. I didn't know what it was. I didn't know that adjectives had an order. I didn't know the difference between, tense and aspect. And I didn't even know the most fundamental things about language.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I just got hooked on knowing. And since then, I've been on a mission to try and know all of it, which is impossible because language is just too big.
You're trying to learn English.
Yeah. I think that is a fair description of what I'm trying to do.
Actually. Okay. So when did you decide to start the YouTube channel? Is that 5 years ago?
Yeah, 2015.
Yeah.
It's funny because that was when my son had just turned one. He just turned one. And there was a lot of stress during that time because I was trying to I was teaching because I live in a small town. In order to make enough money to live, you have to do a lot of hours because mm-hmm. there's a maximum to how much you can charge per hour for your classes.
Yes.
So I was doing, it depended on the day, but I was doing at least 8 teaching hours a day.
Yeah.
So 8 teaching hours actually means 12 hours at the school every day, right? Because you have to prepare for classes and there's admin stuff and photocopying, you know.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of photocopying.
That's right. Unfortunately, yes.
Yes. And it's just you know, I think it might be in a way, in a kind of twisted way, I think for some people it's a badge of honor to say, you know, I teach 8 classes a day, but it's not a good thing. I think that you get burnt out. You can't give good classes when you're teaching that many hours.
Yeah, I've been there too. I've been there, done that, got the T-shirt. Spent many years just totally exhausting myself in classes. Having, you know, often having a great time, sometimes having a terrible time, but yes, exhausting, punishing. It's a punishing routine. Yeah.
Isn't it interesting? Don't you think that it's difficult for people outside to kind of understand why just talking, for example, is kind of exhausting?
Yeah, it annoys me quite a lot that a lot of people, a lot of my friends, even my family, don't have any idea what I do. I think that they often think that it's just me in some nice little comfortable space with three Japanese children in front of me, and I'm going red, blue, yellow, yay, okay, that's it. You know, that's what they think. And some of my friends think that it's just like a holiday job. You know, I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine once who was saying to me, you know, I'm really fed up with my career. I'm thinking of dropping out and becoming a TEFL teacher. I was like, what do you mean dropping out? You're like, yeah, all right, yeah, drop out and become a TEFL teacher. Yeah, you'll see what it's like. It's not, you know, because I think for some people, it's like they do a year off from university, or they finish university, they go traveling for a year, and teaching English is something that they do, but not in a very serious way for a year. So people associate English teaching with, you know, being a student, traveling and stuff like that. But in the actual real world, It's pretty tough stuff if you're trying to make your living from doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And it's difficult for people to understand like why it's exhausting, because, you know, you're not digging holes, right? You're not digging a hole for a swimming pool. You're kind of in a room, but there's just, I don't know, there's just after, especially, and I'm sure you've had this kind of student, right? It's like they come to class and they say, I want to learn how to speak. You know, I want to pay you because you're a native speaker. I want to be fluent at conversation. You know, okay, great. And they come to class and you say, how are you? And they say, good. So what did you do yesterday? Nothing. Yeah, okay. Okay, great. So you're paying to talk and you're not talking. You know, you're paying to talk. You're not taking the opportunity to, and this is, I think, a problematic student mindset, right? Is it like people want to passively sit and they want someone to fill them with language, right? Yep. Like the job of the teacher is to fill me with, you know, with information, with fluency. But, you know, it's not like that, is it? They have to do the hard work.
Yeah, that's right. People think that, and it's kind of like going back to what we said before about sort of buying an app or buying an English course. They think that essentially, I suppose, what they think is that they're giving the responsibility to someone else. It's like, I've paid my money, and here you go. Now, as you said, fill me with English. Go.
Yes.
And it's not how it works, unfortunately.
No. So it can be. I wish more students knew that, right? And I wish that that became. It's almost like we need to have a course, like a pre-course, for all language learners that kind of says, okay, listen, before you go on the learning process, here's what you need to know about actually learning a language. That's what should be, it should be mandatory, right?
And it can, you know, it can be like, I'm here to help you. You know, I've got lots of experience and I know, you know, what you, you know, I can help, I can explain these things and give you, I can facilitate your language learning, but ultimately I can't learn it for you. You've got to do it for yourself. So, but then YouTube. So after slaving away for 8 hours a day or 12 hours a day, you thought maybe I can like do something else, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to steal an expression that I heard from the film director Ridley Scott. He said in an interview, he said, "I like to squeeze myself through the eye of a needle," and so I kind of I'm a glutton for punishment, so I decided to start a YouTube channel, and I said to myself, I think the main reason I wanted to do it was because when I looked at a lot of other classes on the internet, I always thought, well, that's just not right. That's not true. That's not right. And I, you know, there's that typical thing where I thought, well, I can do better. You know, I can do this. I can do better.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're familiar with the Dunning-Kruger curve.
It's another thing that I sort of... Is that the bell curve that goes like this?
Yeah, basically it's Dunning-Kruger is basically that when you know a small amount about something, you think that you know a lot about it, right?
Okay.
And only over time does your ignorance kind of really get revealed. You know, it's like there's nothing that there's... In the same way that there's nobody who's more anti-smoking than an ex-smoker, right?
Right.
I think there's nothing more dangerous than an English teacher who only knows a little bit about English, right?
Yes.
if you sort of know what I mean, because, and I was there, that's where I was at that point, you know. I thought that I knew everything, and I thought that I could do better than everybody else, and I thought that I had the way. But really, I was really ignorant.
How? In what way? What did you think you knew? What were you, yeah.
I think that I thought, well, no, I did think that perfection in language came from knowing like all of the technical details of language.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny because that's not what I practiced in my physical classes with students. I always did a lot of kind of conversation. But my online presence was essentially like a video version of a grammar book. You know, really like so lists of stuff, all the exceptions to things. It was really heavily focused on that idea.
What's wrong with that though? What's wrong with, showing people, hey, look, this is how we say it and this is how we don't say it. So avoid saying this and try to say this. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, but it wasn't even that. It was literally, I think the first 10 videos I made were like present simple and then present continuous. And then, it was basically the typical, because I'd absorbed that. I thought that was the way to teach a language because that's what the industry does in general.
Yeah,
it's like
like English grammar in use. It's literally page, you know, it's the contents page goes through grammar points bit by bit, and it's kind of that seems to be the standard way to learn and teach a language, is that you do incremental bits of grammar step by step
and so that I copied that, you know, that approach. But I think over time I realized that, well, number one, I didn't really enjoy making that kind of content because it just was a lot of regurgitation of existing knowledge in terms of, like, there's so many excellent grammar books that can explain the technical details of language.
Yeah.
You know, I don't really think that more of that's kind of necessary. You know, that our understanding of all that is actually really good in a lot of ways. And then I kind of realized that actually success or failure depends much more on the things that we've been talking about, like setting achievable goals, being motivated, understanding how to study rather than, you know, studying, you know, many, many, many hours in the wrong way.
Mm-hmm.
I started to realize that stuff was much more important. So now my content is a lot more, I would say, less directly useful. I'm a little bit worried that I've gone too far the other way now, and that my content is too abstract and it's veering too far into kind of psychology and philosophy. So I need to pull myself back a little bit.
Yeah, but I think that there's something to be said for making content that you really love doing, because then your enthusiasm will come through, and ultimately that's just going to provide people with a source of English that they feel good about, that they like, that they're motivated to listen to, and your fans will love watching your content. And as a result, they're just getting English in a personal way, which I think is really beneficial. And if you're inspiring people and just helping people to get that little bit more English in their daily lives, then I think you're doing a good thing. I mean, your videos have got, how can I say it? You're a very good speaker. What did I write down? I wrote down things that I'm sort of impressed by when I see your stuff. So your way of putting complex things into simple terms. You like using metaphors.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with metaphors. Yeah.
your speaking style, you sort of speak slowly, but it's not just about speaking slowly. You also choose your words very carefully. You clearly put a lot of love into the work, and also the videos look good. And this is all stuff that comes across, and it makes it pleasant to see your content. And I think that's really important.
Kind. Yeah, a lot of people ask me if I speak like this normally, or if if I put it on, for my videos. But I speak like this all the time, and I think that it's just a result of my work, because there's kind of I think there's two types of content on the internet for language learners. You know, there's content which is designed to be completely kind of authentic. You know, it's like content where it's let's say unscripted, natural conversations between people where they're using idioms and slang and swearing and that kind of absorbing all that content prepares students for the reality of conversation and the reality of real world language use, and that's all super important stuff, but I'm not trying to do that. I'm interested in transmitting a message, and so I use really simple vocabulary, and I choose my words carefully, and I enunciate because I don't want my language to actually be a barrier. Want the idea to be clearly transmitted, and I'm not trying to be a model for, let's say, an average, English speaker.
But this is a really important thing. There's different types of English for different types of situation. So, for example, a lot of my episodes, I am talking to friends and doing what you said, having these authentic conversations. And I think that is how we often will talk to people in our lives. We have these messy conversations where they go off in different directions, a bit like the conversation we're having today. And that's appropriate for that kind of situation. But then sometimes, as a speaker of English, you will have to, for example, give a presentation at work or something like that. Or you'll have to communicate a complex message in a simple way and do it on your own. And that's when you have to adapt your English. And if you do it like you, you'll probably be a lot more effective. If you go up and say, today I'm going to kind of talk about some stuff, and then you make some jokes, and then you, I'm getting distracted, and blah, blah, blah. That's not really going to be an effective way to use your 10-minute presentation slot. If you're going to do a TED Talk, for example, you've got to do it the way that you do it, because that's how you hold people's attention and you get the message across. That's how the best, for example, politicians will communicate. If you think of, if you think of someone like Barack Obama, a lot of his stuff, it's very brief. He will speak like this, and he will say a simple thing, and leave a big space, and then he will say something else. You know, and it delivers it could be a complex thing or anything, but he will deliver it in this very simple way. Like we're gonna have some breakfast, and then we're going to go to work. That's just my Barack Obama impression. But
it's so good. I can't. Your Barack Obama impression is amazing. Wow. This is a secret talent.
I like to do impressions of American presidents. Don't ask me to do Trump because it's...
Okay.
Anyway, so the point is, though, that your way of communicating is a good example of how sometimes you have to slow down, less is more, and break up your sentences in order to communicate the message.
Yeah, no, I think you gave a great example when you talked about TED Talks, because, a TED Talk, you'll find that, people are very careful with the language they use. They'll speak really slowly. They'll enunciate more. They'll leave longer pauses because that's the right forum. That's the right place to use that kind of language. And I think, you know, that's another thing that learners, you know, need to get good at, right? Is not just communicating in one way. It's about variation. You know, and to me, that's kind of a little bit of the problem with a lot of mass-produced like learning materials is that they're very homogenous. You know, it's always like the same kind of English talking about the same kind of subjects. I mean, if I imagine that if you, and I can't say this empirically, you know,
yeah,
but I imagine that if you looked at the table of contents of the top 50 grammar books that are used in the world, I would say that the chapters would be probably all about the same things. And they would contain probably the same vocabulary and, you know, the same kind of activities and, you know.
Yes. Yes, I think so. What's it like being a YouTuber? I mean, moving not just about teaching English and stuff, but just like producing content for YouTube. What's it like doing YouTube?
You know, I'm it's an interesting job, you know, because I mean, it's not actually my full-time job. You know, I don't make enough money and I don't produce enough content to be a full-time YouTuber. You know, it's something that I'm doing in order to try and spread a kind of bigger message. But I think probably the best thing about YouTube is that it allows anybody to access an enormous audience. You know, the idea that even let's say 20 years ago, the idea that a person could have 10,000 people or 50,000 people listen to their content. I mean, that's an amazing thing that's only, you know, happening now. But this is something that's kind of related to what we've been talking about. Sometimes, you know, the hardest part of being a YouTuber is the pressure to create, you know, and that's exhausting in a kind of different way because, you know, especially as your audience grows and there's more people, you kind of feel like, well, I can't just sit at a table and make a video about this because that's not good enough for this many subscribers. You know, I need to spend time to make the video with this production quality and this content and right. So I think that the pressure to constantly produce, the pressure to produce the right type of content, I think it actually grows over time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I know that probably a lot of people will consider a lot of YouTubers like, let's say, snowflakes. You know, there's plenty of like, let's say, big popular like vloggers who have quit. They say, I'm off YouTube because I can't take the pressure anymore. And people say, what are you talking about pressure? You know, all you do is just drive your Ferrari around and make.
Yeah.
But it's a kind of it's an unusual. I think it's okay. Maybe this is getting a little bit too deep, right?
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about it, this is a unique moment in human history where people put themselves out there to an enormous amount of people, and it can go either way, right? It can be good or bad, and sometimes if it's bad, I think it can really affect people.
Yeah, you know? Totally. Like for me, I don't know, a few years ago when my audience wasn't as big as it is now, I felt a lot more liberated to just do whatever the hell I wanted to do. And there, I used to be able to just like come in, get my microphone, switch it on and just start talking and just make stuff up on the spot. And there were some episodes where I really sort of surprised myself with the level of improvisational comedy that I came out with, because that's kind of my thing as well, you know.
Yeah.
And just making up stories, just rambling off the top of my head, making it up as I went along and feeling completely free to do it. And these days, sometimes I'm like desperate to do the same thing and I switch the microphone on and I'm already second guessing myself because I know that because I've got a bigger audience, the stakes are much higher And yes. all it takes is for a small percentage of your audience to not like what you're doing, and it yeah. and it hurts. Even if like everyone else loves it, if that small percentage doesn't like it, it hurts. And that small percentage yeah. grows as your audience grows. And so you feel
yes.
more and more pressure, and you feel more and more limited by it. And it requires a lot more energy and a lot more bravery to take risks as your audience grows. Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. And also imagine if the reason that you're growing, the reason that your audience loves your content is because you used to just sit and improvise.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then the pressure means that you don't do that anymore. So your content changes.
Yeah.
It's a weird thing,
it's
right?
It's an extremely weird situation to find yourself in, where yeah. you get stuck, you get pushed into a corner, in a sense. And so, I mean, I could, and I'm sure I've got people in my audience now who are going, yeah, please do more of that stupid stuff. Yeah. And I should and I could, but it's hard. It's hard to free yourself to the extent where you don't care what the reaction is going to be. Yeah, it's pretty tough. Yeah, it's pretty draining.
There's a song by the White Stripes. Mm-hmm. They were an American rock band, and the song, it's just like a short song, and it says something like, "When you start as a musician, you start off in your little room, and then you're making your music in your little room, and then all of a sudden you're in the stadium, right? Mm-hmm. And you've got 100,000 people listening to your music, but then after a while, you realize that you need to go back to your little room again."
Yeah.
That's basically what the song is about. I can't remember the exact lyrics, but... And I often think that that is actually the kind of the trajectory that's necessary, you know? Because how often do you see it, right? With musicians, you know, with filmmakers, with writers. You know, they start with this amazing little thing, and then it gets so big, and the quality just goes, or the heart goes, or
it crushes
them.
They
have to go back. Yeah, they have to go back to the small room again.
This is one
know,
of
the beginning.
I'm a huge fan of the Beatles, and particularly Paul McCartney at the moment. Mm-hmm. I just love the way at this point in time we're kind of revising our version of the Beatles story, and Paul, suddenly everyone is realizing how amazing Paul is. But one of the things that always impresses me so much is that, so off the back of the breakup of the Beatles, when they just, you know, they released Abbey Road to huge critical acclaim, and it's Abbey Road and stuff, Paul goes off and makes his own solo album. And it's exactly what you said. It's just literally him in his kitchen with a little four-track recorder, doing all the instruments himself, and it's absolutely brilliant. It's like it's so ahead of its time, and I wow. just admire Paul for being able to do that. That he went off and made a little homemade album, and that was his first statement after quitting the biggest band in the world, and he had the bravery to do it. And then he did it again in 1980 when Wings broke up. He did another okay. one, another homemade album, which is like this really weird synthesizer music, totally bizarre and not what you'd expect from Paul McCartney of you know, Hey Jude fame. And by the way, he's about to release another one. He made it really? During lockdown, and everyone's all really? The Paul McCartney fans are getting excited about it. McCartney 3. Anyway, but yes, it's a strange...
Yeah, I mean, imagine like you said, the bravery, right? The bravery of... we can only imagine how much money he had, and you know, the record companies would have been willing to pay any money for a new album from him. And he could have hired writers and gone into the best studios yeah. in the world, but he went into the kitchen.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome.
Yeah,
right.
It was just him and his wife, and you know, he had a baby daughter at the time, and he just scaled it right back to on a farm in Scotland. On a dilapidated wow. old farm in Scotland. Yeah, amazing that he did that. Right.
Well, how far back would you have to go, do you think?
Oh, I don't know if I'd have to go that far back, really. I mean, I guess I've just sort of compared myself to Paul McCartney, haven't I? Have I just done that?
No, I just... Maybe your next post on Twitter will be you in like a stone cottage in the Cotswolds or something.
Ah, that would be lovely. No, I don't think I'd have to go that far back, to be honest. I think I don't have the same level of pressure on me as Paul. But still, it's an inspiration. So, yeah, I wouldn't have to go that far back. I think maybe I could just take a risk and just record some nonsense. But it's quite hard to do that when you think too much about how people are going to react.
Yes.
The best way is just to switch off the editor and just go for it.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, as you said, you know, I love metaphor, right? And I think that there's a metaphor here, in that. You know, okay, so a lot of language learning is like the constant chase for more, right? Like, I need more grammar, I need more vocabulary. You know, it's this constant, well, language acquisition, right? It's about acquiring new skills. But Paul Nation's research. So Paul Nation is a professor from New Zealand. I can't remember which university, but he does lots of research about vocabulary acquisition, especially. And his research shows that about 25%, so a quarter of any good language course, will be what he calls fluency development, which means that you don't spend any time learning anything new. You spend a quarter of your time just repeating the stuff you already know again and again and again and again and again and again, until it becomes automatic. And so, you know, I would say that it's a bit like going back to basics, right? Like, if a student is bored of learning new vocabulary, okay, stop. It's fine. Like, you probably have enough. Like, just go back now and go back into your little room and just practice what you already have and make that awesome.
Yeah. And I really believe in the importance of just messing around.
Uh-huh.
And just faffing about, just having stupid fun, which is, it's something I always want to do in my lessons, but it's difficult to do because obviously the students come loaded with so many expectations. It's hard to totally change their minds and let them see the value of just messing around and having silly fun in class. But there have been times when I've had the right students and I've been in the right place and I've done it. And it's just been amazing, you know, where the students are being really funny and they you can sense that they've gained a lot of confidence from being funny in English and having fun. There's a lot of value to it.
Yeah. Well, in fact, I was listening to a podcast recently. It's the show about language called The Allusionist. I don't know if you know of it.
Helen Zaltzman.
Helen Zaltzman, exactly.
Yeah, The Allusionist.
And there's one episode which is about poetry, and there's this type of poetry that originated in Japan, and it's basically all about restriction. And what I found fascinating about the episode was that essentially, restricting yourself leads to imagination and creativity. So, like, for example, these poets, they set themselves challenges like, you have to write a poem and you're not allowed to use any, you're not allowed to use the letter A. Or you have to write a poem and every single sentence has to start with the word dog, you know? And so these kind of creative restrictions actually produce amazing results. And I think there's something to be said about, the power of a limited ability in a way, right? It's like, imagine how much fun students would have in class if you said, right, I want you to, write a short story, and you're not allowed to use any, you're not allowed to use any adjectives or, you know, whatever it is. I think it would be great fun. They would love that.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think so.
Yeah.
Is there a kind of final message? You like messages. Is there some sort of final message that we can use to wrap up this conversation?
I mean, to me, because we're talking about, you know, going back to the Paul McCartney, we're back in his room and you know, going back, I kind of feel like that some of the stuff we talked about at the beginning of this conversation was really important, you know, for language learners in that, you know, I think that success in language learning is about either having a need or creating a need, you know? So If you have a need, like because you're living in Paris and because your wife only speaks French or because you're working in a French company, well, in a way, the motivation will take care of itself because you'll be forced to do it. A lot of language learners aren't in that situation, right? They're going to class and they're adults, right? They're busy people. But you have to spend time to create the necessity, whether that's like you, with your deep interest in graphic novels, or whether it's like booking an online class with a teacher to have conversation, like making it a, you know, make what's the word? Holding yourself
to account,
holding yourself accountable, right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You have to create need, I think. Yeah.
Yes, I agree. I agree. Yeah. Okay. Christian, thank you so much. Good luck with the charity project.
Thank you, sir.
Kangaroo English. That's kangaroo.com/donate.
Exactly.
People can check out your YouTube channel. They can see you reading from the dictionary for 18 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
Your retinas are still attached. Amazingly enough.
Barely.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks for talking to me. It's been really interesting, and good luck for whatever you do next.
Thank you, sir. So, the same to you.
Okay, mate.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Are you happy with that?
Yeah, I'm very happy with that. It's great.
Okay.
I'm going to stop recording. So that was Christian from Kangaroo English. Come on, that was good, wasn't it? I hope you agree that there were plenty of solid bits of insight about language learning there from two teachers who've been working for years to actually help people learn English. Thank you again to Christian for talking to us and for giving his sincere and thoughtful comments on all the stuff that I asked him about. Remember, there is a video version of this episode and you'll find it on YouTube. Luke's English Podcast is the channel name. Don't forget to like and subscribe, okay? Smash that like button, okay, guys? Seriously, though, why not watch the video now that you've heard the audio? It could be a good way to reinforce what you've heard, and there's a good chance that you'll understand a lot more the second time round. My episodes are often long and have a lot in them, so listening or watching more than once is definitely worthwhile if you can find the time to do it. Also, check out Kangaroo English on YouTube if you haven't already done so. Have a look at his dictionary challenge if you want to see a man suffering in front of vocab. Otherwise, have a look at the various videos that he's made about the psychology of learning English and lots more. A quick note before the end about Wispolep, the competition. I'm working on the next part of that, so stay tuned and watch this space. Also, I'm working on premium content, which should be coming soon. But otherwise, there's a large library of episodes there for you to work with, including pronunciation drills, which I think might be some of the most valuable of the premium episodes, actually. teacherluke.co.uk/premium info. But finally, then, I feel inspired to sing a song with my guitar. So if you're not a fan of, I don't know what, if you're not a fan of music, or at least my version of music, then now's the time to, I don't know, go and do something else. But otherwise, I hope you stick with me. The tune I'm going to do is called Wonderful World. And it's not the Louis Armstrong one, you know, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. It's not that one, although that is a lovely song as well. No, this one is the one by Sam Cooke. Maybe you know it. You may have heard it. It's a classic. And I've chosen this one because I'd like to dedicate it to my lovely wife, who has more patience than I gave her credit for in this episode. You'll find the chords and lyrics on the page for this episode if you'd like to sing along or learn it for yourself. But otherwise, I'm going to sing for you, and then that will be the end of this episode. And I'll say bye, bye, bye at the end. All right then? Okay. Don't Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. Don't know much about geography. Don't know much trigonometry. Don't know much about algebra. Don't know what a slide rule is for. But I do know one and one is two. And if this one could be with you, what a wonderful world this would be. Now I don't claim to be an A student, but I'm trying to be. For maybe by being an A student, baby, I could win your love for me. Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. History, biology, science book, the French I took. But I do know that I love you. And I know that if you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be. Goodbye. Bye, 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 bye. Thanks for listening to Luke's English podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.